Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Today on our program, Fran Michel will be sharing with us a reading from Rosa Luxemburg's Socialism or Barbarism. Larry Bolden is here to review Ella Carey's 2018 novel, The Things We Don't Say. And concluding our program, our Left on the Law commentator, Mike Snedeker, will be interviewing Jen Smith, an immigration lawyer who lives and practices at the border. But now, leading off today, Bill Resnick interviews Brenna Bell, who has an extensive background in environmental law and education, and who got a law degree and now builds the BARC movement, for which she is policy director and attorney, as well as being an activist and protector of the forest. Bill?
Brenna Bell, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thank you.
Brenna's an activist in the woods, fighting destructive logging on the ground, preserving Oregon's forests and waters. She's also the policy director and attorney for the organization BARC that has been in the leadership in preserving old-growth forests and fighting destructive forest and water practices in Oregon, especially in Mount Hood, for 20 years. Over those years, the need for forest protection became ever more insistent, as we have learned that modern logging and forest practices still in use around the world produce considerable greenhouse gas emissions. And today it's widely appreciated that reforestation and improved forestry practices are crucial to stop global heating and its threat to human existence. Before we get to what has to be done, give us a rundown on the considerable impact of logging and forest practices on climate change.
Sure, Bill. This is something that I'm really excited about talking about right now, because I think it's been just missing from both conversations around climate change and around forest management, and that is the amazing role that forests play in the carbon cycle. And as most people know, in Oregon, you know, most of our state is heavily forested on the west side and some on the east side. And our state has an amazing capacity to sequester carbon in its forests. Just amazing. We're some of the top forests in the nation, this ecosystem for carbon sequestration. And unfortunately, as you all know, Oregon's history around logging has been to take out almost all of our old growth trees. So our forests are in this huge, huge deficit for the amount of carbon they could be sequestering. So we have a situation where we have this amazing asset, which is our forests, which can sequester carbon. And instead, they're being logged, and that's releasing the carbon to such an extent that recent studies have shown that logging emissions in Oregon are the number one source of carbon in the state, bigger than the transportation sector, bigger than the energy sector. Is logging, and they're not accounted for in the state's carbon accounting. And so we have this huge source of emissions where we could have an amazing ally in carbon sequestration. So looking at forests and their role in carbon is becoming ever more important. I mean, the good folks at 350 are focused on having 350 parts per million, but we're already over that, right? We're about 404 parts per million. And so we need to start thinking about what can pull carbon out of the atmosphere also, and that's where forests come in.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the ways in which logging and all forest practices, like the road building, the destruction of soils, all of it. Tell us about those specific things. We can't go into much detail on this show, but there are a lot of information on the BARC website and many others. But tell us about the specific ways that that carbon emissions are so increased by deforestation.
Sure. I mean, I think that the first main thing to know is that trees are humongous sticks of carbon. Every part of them is made of carbon. So you have the trunk, which is where most of it is, but a lot of it's also in the root system, which people don't think about, and the branches and the leaves. And so when a tree is cut, a lot of that carbon is lost way more speedily than would be in a natural decomposition process. And oftentimes you hear now people talk about wood as this green building material that stores carbon. And that's true, but it stores about 15% of the carbon that a live tree stores. About 15%, because the rest of it is lost in rapid decomposition.
And then sometimes it gets burned. This furniture or houses are wrecked, and they wind up in landfills, and then they're...
Right. And most wood products, most trees don't become houses or furniture. They don't become things that have long lives. They become newspapers and magazines and toilet paper and wood chips and pallets, things that are one use and then go to the landfill. And so all of that carbon is going to decompose much, much more rapidly than it would if it was left in the forest. You know, forest activists have been thinking a lot about the slogan, keep it in the ground, that a lot of fossil fuel activists have been talking about for different fossil fuels, and Senator Merkley is really behind. We like to say, keep it in the forest. The best place that we could store our carbon is in the live trees.
And in the soils.
And in the soils,
absolutely. The soils get disturbed, and when they get disturbed, they lose, it gets oxidized, the carbon, in the, and it becomes carbon dioxide.
Yeah, and all the root systems and all the fungal and all the mycelium, all the systems underneath the soil, all break down.
They all break down.
There's so much going on in forests, and, you know, modern management thinks that we know the best thing to do, and now a lot of logging is positioned as forest health logging. They say the forests are sick and they're overstocked, and so we have to log. That's just exactly going the wrong way.
Yeah, there's also... Well, the ruination of waters and the change in the microclimates when the trees are cut down, which then reduces the growth of trees in adjacent areas and changes the microclimate so much that it stresses the trees. But I don't think we can get into that because, Brenna, this is KBU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, the old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Bill Resnick talking to Brenna Bell, who is the... policy director, attorney, and activist. She's in the forest with all of the troops. What happens when you're arrested? Can you represent yourself?
I don't do criminal defense, Bill. Then I go to the lawyers who know that.
Okay. You know what they say about a good lawyer? They are bad lawyers for themselves, whatever that line is. Anyway, we've discussed the forest practices that are so, make such a huge contribution is the wrong word. They release massive amounts of greenhouse gas emissions, but they don't have to.
They don't have to.
As Brenna Bell has pointed out, they could, in fact, technical word is sequester, but they could gather
up
and, in fact, create natural environments for all sorts of reasons, including cleaning water.
Yeah.
I mean, they're
and cooling water.
And cooling water, yes. They're crucial parts of a natural environment that provides the basis of human life. Tell us what has to be done. There can be some forestry and some wood products.
Yes, absolutely. I mean...
But tell us what has to be done.
There was a recent study that made coming out of Oregon State University that made several recommendations of how we can transform forests from major carbon emitters to carbon sequesterers. And two of their main recommendations was immediately stop logging old mature and old growth forests. Just stop. Keep those massive stores of carbon in the ground. And the second was to increase the cutting rotation on those forests that we have deemed to be crops or plantations, double it from 40 years to 80 years.
That is not increase the speed. They don't want to speed it up.
No.
Slow it down.
Exactly. Increase the length of time between which you log. And one of the ones that we're really focused on in BARC is the first, is stopping old growth logging on national forests. And a lot of people listening might think, wait, I thought you did that. And you know what? We thought we did that too, because Mount Hood National Forest has not proposed to log mature and old growth forests for the last decade. But now they are again. They're going exactly the wrong way. And again, they're positioning it as forest health. One of the timber sales that we're back in court for the first time in many years fighting is called the Crystal Clear Restoration Project.
Restoration.
Yeah, it's all restoration, Bill.
Yeah.
And so they're restoring these old growth forests, forests up to 300 years old. They're restoring them by taking half of the trees out, because if they don't log the trees, then they might burn. Of course, if they do log the trees, they also might burn. Forests burn. It's what they do. And it's what they're supposed to do. And logging it usually makes fire patterns worse.
But natural forests, when they burn, preserves most of the carbon in the old wood.
Exactly.
Which falls to the ground finally and becomes part of the earth. Yeah, the burning is a very small amount, actually.
About 95% of the carbon stays in a forest after a fire. Only about 5% of the biomass of a forest actually burns. It's way smaller than people thought. There's a study came out 2 weeks ago from the University of Idaho that was looking exactly at that issue, because the researchers thought that there were people that were grossly overstating the amount of carbon released in forest fires. And so they decided to really look at that question, and they found that their assumption was correct. People are grossly overstating the amount of carbon that's released in forest fires. Almost all of it stays in the forest, and that which gets released gets sucked back in by all the new growth, because fires are a huge cleaner out of the forest, and they just bring burgeoning new growth in that then starts the carbon cycle all over again.
Yeah. Look, let's emphasize, we only have a couple minutes, let's emphasize the need for changing forest practices whole lot, and that it can be done. And then talk about what BARC is doing and what various other, there's all sorts of affiliated organizations all over the world, particularly now that the indigenous are protecting their lands and talking about climate change.
What can be done?
Okay. What can be done?
So much can be done.
Yeah.
One of the first things we're really calling for is an end to volume-driven management on public lands. Right now, the Forest Service is told by people in Congress and Washington, D.C., you must log this amount of timber off of your forest. And that makes everything else suspect. That means restoration projects have to produce timber volume. That means any kind of approach to restorative forestry has to produce a high amount of timber volume, which is not at all correlated to what the market could bear or what the local economy needs. And it certainly does not focus on keeping the biggest and best trees in the forest, because obviously those are the ones that have the most volume. And so we would love to see a shift where our national forests are valued for their carbon sequestration, for their water protection, for the climate refugia that we're going to have in a changing climate, for so many things besides producing commercial timber, and refocus to getting the wood that we do need. We need some, but we could sure use a lot less if we conserved more from places that are already managed as tree plantations.
Now, you are in court now and then, and on Crystal Creek, you're spending more time in court rather than various other
have them playing in the forest.
Do you have all the outfits that are proper for court? I was once an attorney, and I was ruled out because I didn't have a tie. And the probation officer there, one of the staff, said, "Hi, Bill, here's one."
Yeah. So, I do dress appropriately for all my different hats.
But anyway, let's talk about the role of law and court stuff and movements. You pointed out that you win in court when you have big public movements, and if you don't have the movements, you have a real problem.
You have a big problem. You might win on the law even, but you won't affect change. You know, when we're in court, we're trying to implement, you know, federal laws, federal policy on federal land. And those laws and policies were not made to protect the public interest. And insofar as they were, they are the result of public movements. Like the National Environmental Policy Act, which is one of the main laws that we litigate under, came because of the environmental movement of the 70s. And it has been steadily eroded since then. And tools keep getting taken out of that toolbox to the point where now there's a rule that's just been proposed by the federal government to exempt timber sales up to 7,000 acres from public review and review under NEPA, which means litigation tools might just kind of be thrown out the door. And if we don't have a movement, a people's movement, to step in and say, we need a voice in the forest, these are public lands, and their management affects our public health. It affects the climate, our future livability of this area. That's where movements come back in, which is, I love the work that BARC does of using all the tools in the federal policy and law toolbook. But there's also been a gap in Portland around more direct action forest activism, which is where I got my start during the salvage rider era, which is when we had no laws to enforce because they'd been tossed out the door by Congress. So there's now a new group that I'm just going to plug that's called the Climate Forest Alliance, that is focused on getting grassroots organizing and more action-oriented folk back into the forest, because sometimes you need to actually block the roads. It's not what BARC does. It's not even what I do anymore, but I'm sure glad that there's a group like the Climate Forest Alliance there. And if people are interested in it, their email is crystalclearlywrong@riseup.net, and they're focused on that crystal clear timber sale that I mentioned that would log 3,000 acres of old growth as a forest restoration and fuels reduction project.
Rena Bell, really good talking to you.
Thanks, Bill.
Your enthusiasm, I hope, is extremely infectious. And, you know, get out in the forest and breathe some good air.
Thank you. I will. And we at BARC, one of the things we do is really encourage people to come to the forest with us. And we do a public hike every month on the second Saturday. And we do a public campout at the end of August. And this year, we're celebrating our 20th anniversary in the forest at our base camp. And we're really excited to get people out to the forest and find out what they love and learn, get tools to protect it as best we can.
Thanks a lot again.
Thanks.
See you in the forest.
Yeah.
Rainforest, mist and mystery, teeming green. Green brain facing the bottom. Climate control center for the world. Ancient cord coexistence hacked by parasitic greedhead scam. From Sarawak to Amazonas, Costa Rica to mangy BC hills, cortege rhythm of falling timber. What kind of currency grows in these new deserts, these brand new floodplains?
Well, that was Bruce Coburn, If a Tree Falls in the Forest. And this is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the OMO Variety Hour. Rosa Luxemburg was the Polish-German World War I era socialist and pacifist who was murdered for her political activities by the ruling SPD shortly after the end of the war. Fran Michel is here to share a reading from her collected writings, Socialism or Barbarism.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel for the Well-Read Red, with some comments on socialism or barbarism, a slogan most associated with the work of Rosa Luxemburg. Luxemburg was born in Russian-controlled Poland in 1871 to a Jewish family, and early in her life became a socialist, activist, and theorist, earning a PhD from the University of Zurich. Her most politically active years were spent mostly in Germany. Against the reformist direction of the German Social Democratic Party, of which she was a member, Luxemburg argued that although reformist activity could be a means of class struggle, revolution would be needed to overthrow capitalism. Against the repressive conciliation of businesses by trade union leaders, she advocated for the mass strike as the spontaneous action of workers. Against Lenin's democratic centralism, she insisted on the need for real democracy as essential to socialism. She analyzed the process of accumulation to show the development of capitalism toward imperialism. So when the German Social Democrats in Parliament voted to fund the war in 1914, She saw it as a betrayal of the international solidarity of the working classes. This led her to break from the Social Democrats and co-found the German Communist Party. It also led to her writing The Crisis of Social Democracy, better known as the Junius pamphlet, after the pseudonym with which she signed it. It's the classic source of the phrasing of socialism or barbarism. The pamphlet opens with a description of the shift from patriotic anticipation of war to the grim reality of it. Quote, "The scene has changed fundamentally. Mass slaughter has become the tiresome and monotonous business of the day, and the end is no closer. Gone is the euphoria, gone the patriotic noise in the streets. In the prosaic atmosphere of pale day, there sounds a different chorus, the hoarse cries of the vulture and the hyenas of the battlefield. Business thrives in the ruins. Cities become piles of ruins. Villages become cemeteries. Countries, deserts. Populations are beggared. Churches, horse stalls. International law, treaties and alliances, the most sacred words and the highest authority, have been torn in shreds. Every diplomat is a cunning rascal to his colleagues in the other party. Every government sees every other as dooming its own people and worthy only of universal contempt. There are food riots in Venice, in Lisbon, Moscow, Singapore. There is plague in Russia and misery and despair everywhere. Violated, dishonored, wading in blood, dripping filth, there stands bourgeois society. This is it, in reality, not all spick and span and moral with pretense to culture, philosophy, ethics, order, peace, and the rule of law, but the ravening beast, a plague to culture and humanity. Thus it reveals itself in its true, its naked form. One thing is certain, the World War is a turning point. It is foolish and mad to imagine that we need only to survive the war, like a rabbit waiting out the storm under a bush, in order to fall happily back into the old routine once it's over. The World War has altered the conditions of our struggle, and most of all, it has changed us. Not that the basic law of capitalist development, the life and death war between capital and labor, will experience any amelioration. But now, in the midst of the war, the masks are falling, and the old familiar visages smirk at us. The tempo of development has received a mighty jolt from the eruption of the volcano of imperialism. The violence of the conflicts in the bosom of society, the enormousness of the tasks that tower up before the socialist proletariat, these make everything that has transpired in the history of the workers' movement seem a pleasant idyll. Friedrich Engels once said, "Bourgeois society stands at the crossroads, either transition to socialism or regression into barbarism." What does regression into barbarism mean to our lofty European civilization? This world war is a regression into barbarism. The triumph of imperialism leads to the annihilation of civilization. At first, this happens sporadically for the duration of a modern war, but then when the period of unlimited wars begins, it progresses toward its inevitable consequences. Today we face the choice exactly as Friedrich Engels foresaw it, either the triumph of imperialism and the collapse of all civilization, as in ancient Rome, depopulation, desolation, degeneration, a great cemetery, or the victory of socialism. That means the conscious, active struggle of the international proletariat against imperialism and its method of war. This is a dilemma of world history, an either-or. The scales are wavering before the decision of the class-conscious proletariat. The future of civilization and humanity depends on whether or not the proletariat resolves to throw its revolutionary broadsword into the scales. In this war, imperialism has won. Its bloody sword of genocide has brutally tilted the scales toward the abyss of misery. The only compensation for all the misery and all the shame would be if we learn from the war how the proletariat can seize mastery of its own destiny and escape the role of the lackey to the ruling classes. End quote. The slogan socialism or barbarism thus points toward both the barbarism of the destruction created by world war and also toward the evils embedded in the ordinary workings of bourgeois capitalism itself. For Luxembourg, economic expansion and the resulting devastation of the environment was an inherent feature of capitalism. In The Accumulation of Capital, she explained that, by definition, capital needed to conquer, absorb, and destroy non-capitalist economies and territories in order to survive. Ian Angus of Climate and Capitalism observes that their slogan is eco-socialism or barbarism. There is no third way. With the explanation that eco-socialism is not a new theory or brand of socialism. It's a socialism with Marx's important insights on ecology restored, socialism committed to the fight against ecological destruction. More than 10 years ago, the vice president of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was already arguing that climate change would lead us to barbarization unless governments acted quickly to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Without that, he suggested, climate change will lead to a fortress world in which the rich lock themselves away in gated communities and the poor must fend for themselves in shattered environments. It may be easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, but we do still have a choice to imagine and work to create the more difficult possibility. Alluding to Marx, Luxemburg reminds us that people do not make history according to their own free will, but they make history nonetheless. So let us make a history that will persist. For the Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
Auf, auf zum Kampf, zum Kampf sind wir geboren. Auf, auf zum Kampf, zum Kampf sind wir bereit. Den Karl Liebknecht, dem haben wir's geschworen. Der Rosa Luxemburg reichen wir die Hand. Dem Karl Liebknecht, dem haben wir's geschworen. Steht ein Mann, so fest wie eine Eiche. Er hat gewiss, schon manchen Sturm erlebt. Vielleicht ist er schon morgen eine Leiche, wie es so vielen Freiheitskämpfen. Vielleicht ist er schon morgen eine Leiche, wie es so vielen Freiheitskämpfern geht. Wir fürchten nicht, ja nicht, den Donner der Kanone. Wir fürchten nicht, ja nicht, die grüne Polizei, den Karl Liebknecht, den haben wir verloren. Die Rosa Luxemburg fiel durch Mörder.
That was the German singer Hans Vader singing Auf, auf, zum Kampf. Up, up, let's fight. It's a classic song of the German left, with an early version coming to prominence during the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71. In 1919, Bertolt Brecht wrote a new version in reaction to the murders of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. That was the version sung by Vader. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now Larry Bolden, our fiction critic, reviews Ella Carey's 2018 novel, The Things We Don't Say, an historical novel set in the London of 1900s and loosely based, or at least inspired, by a collective of young writers and artists famously known as the Bloomsbury Group. Larry?
Good morning. Those of you readers who have read earlier works of Ella Carey know that she has had a lifelong love affair with France, as is manifest in her books Paris Time Capsule and The House by the Lake. In her 2018 novel, The Things We Don't Say, the action switches back and forth between London and a country farmhouse in Provence, As Carrie is quick to acknowledge, this novel was inspired by the Bloomsbury Group, and although she insists that all the characters are spun from her imagination, in her acknowledgments she says, quote, "I've long been intrigued by the artist Vanessa Bell and her beautiful relationship with her fellow artist Duncan Grant," close quote. In the novel, Emma Temple's story has its background, this intrigue Carrie had with Vanessa Bell, Virginia Woolf, and other writers and artists in the Bloomsbury Group. Emma is an artist who establishes a kind of sanctuary in Provence for the unconventional bohemian young artists who she makes into her family. It is 1913. She lives there with her husband, Oscar, who is really more like a brother or companion than a husband, and among the other guests is a famous painter by the name of Patrick and his lover, Rupert. It is really the deep love between Patrick and Emma that is central to the story, although he is homosexual and she is not. The second strand of the story is told by Emma's granddaughter, Laura, who is studying violin at the Royal College of Music. Thus, the reader is taken back and forth between London in 1980 and Provence in the years leading up to and including World War I and beyond. While Patrick and Emma are not sexual lovers, their love is profound, and Patrick spends years painting a portrait of Emma, though he has refused in the past to do portraits of anyone he knows. The painting is his tribute to their love. Patrick becomes a famous artist, and his works are a huge commercial success. For that reason, the painting Ella has is of great value by the time Laura enters the story. Indeed, his work is so famous that Ella is able to secure a loan using it as collateral, a loan large enough to support Laura's expensive education at the Royal Academy. Just as art and color are everything to Emma, music is everything to Laura, and intensifies the bonds between her and her grandmother. Alas, a well-respected art critic who is considered an expert on Patrick's paintings publishes an article in the Times claiming that the Emma portrait is not his work. All the rest of the novel is occupied with this issue. At first, Ewan, the art critic, refuses to divulge to Laura how he knows the painting is not genuine, although he insists he is absolutely certain that it is not. While the story of the painting and of the threat to Laura's music education is the thread that weaves together the lives of Ella and Laura, what I found to be the overarching significance of the novel was a description of how the so-called bohemians lived their lives in a world that did not at all share their values. Not unlike the young people in the 60s and 70s, Ella's family believes in free love, is open to homosexuality and to all races, and they are also, by and large, pacifists in a world that's about to be engulfed in a world war. Because Ella knows all too well how parents can smother the dreams of their children by refusing to support their endeavors, she empathizes completely with Laura when Laura's parents refuse to support her musical endeavors. Emma's father had likewise refused to support her love of art, and it is only his early death that allows her to continue with her painting. Quoting from the book, "Color was what inspired her, drawing her away from the coldness of her home life. Her childhood walks with her siblings and their nanny in Kensington Gardens every afternoon had started it, and she'd embraced getting out of the dark and stuffy house close to the park. Her delicate senses became assaulted and captivated, drawn in by the blousy, rain-soaked greens and the whites of meadow flowers, the deep reds and brilliant oranges of spring tulips, the fresh air, the blossoms and blue sky and birds. She's wanted to capture it, bottle it as soon as she returned home so it didn't get lost. Nature seemed the opposite of rules, so that was what she drew and painted early on." Close quote. And continuing, a quote from another part of the book, "She learned to put men off by seeming distant. She preferred by far to be thought cold and aloof than to get caught in any way, having to spend the rest of her life stuck as the wife in a repressive Victorian-style household." Close quote. Painting is her refuge and what gives her life meaning and direction. Her older brother Frederick gathers around himself a group of Oxford intellectuals, and when he dies at a very young age, it is she who becomes the keeper of the group, providing a gathering place for the bohemian misfits. Emma's only romantic love is for Patrick, and when her friends scold her for not living with a man who desires her, since she can have anyone, why not choose someone who can love her fully, her reply to Rupert, Patrick's lover, when he puts a move on her and suggests a ménage à trois, quoting from the book, "Love chooses us, just as birth chooses us, just as death chooses us. These things are entirely random. I am unable to sleep with anyone without an emotional connection to them." And she continues, "You are being irrational. You just told me that Patrick loves me. And as for the way I choose to live, is there something wrong with a woman wanting to live life on her own terms? I acknowledge that love is beyond our control, that so much of the world is random, but I insist on the dignity of being able to run the aspects of my life that I can run myself, and that includes saying no to love affairs that will ultimately go nowhere." Close quote. Much like those of us who really came of age in the 60s, Ella's self-made family decides that sexual jealousy is irrational and therefore is to be rejected. Since cool rationality should be the guide in life, whatever is irrational can simply be denied or ignored. Didn't it work out quite that way for us or for Ella's circle? Still, I find their arguments cogent, and I believe we often give up way too much in our lives, including significant relationships, in the name of monogamy and sexual fidelity. Is the famous painting a fraud, and will Laura have to give up her music? These and other plot questions you'll have to answer by reading the book. I've been talking about Ella Carey's novel, The Things We Don't Say. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thanks, Larry. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We wrap things up today with a Left on the Law segment. Mike Snedeker talks with Jim Smith, an attorney and expert witness on asylum cases, about the intensifying crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. Smith is a former professor of law at UC Davis and represents people seeking asylum crossing into the U.S. Mike?
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Jim. Well, the border has become the favorite theater of operations for the Trump administration. You've been living there and working there on both sides of it for decades now. Can you tell us right now who's coming over the border and why?
Yeah, do my best. In thinking about this particular task this morning, it occurred to me that there are striking parallels between the so-called refugee crisis, I call it a foreign policy crisis, of 2014 in the Obama years and the 2018 in the Trump years. What I mean by that is that there was a sudden, apparently sudden influx of refugees from the three Central American countries known as the Northern Triangle of Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. I have mostly done work in Honduras. I was in San Pedro Sula, one of the major sending areas from Honduras in 2016, and have had a number of clients and been an expert witness in a number of Honduran claims. So I'm going to focus on that, although I do believe the situations are parallel in Guatemala and El Salvador. I'm going to focus on a couple of clients in 2014 and then bring it up to date. I was an expert witness for two different women who were members of a PTA in Tegucigalpa in a junior high school. And Laura, I will call her, had a daughter, and Maria had a son. And they were doing their best to protect their respective son and daughter from recruitment for prostitution or for being trained to be hitmen for the street gang, the 18th Street gang, that basically controlled that particular junior high. When I say controlled, I mean the police were, two security guards at the junior high were assassinated. The local police were clearly outgunned by the local gang. And so when these two women sought to protect their children from their position on the PTA, they too were threatened with death if they didn't leave. And so they both chose to leave on their own, but later their cases were never linked, but they were aware of each other's claims. One claim, Laura's, was litigated in San Francisco before an immigration judge. The other claim of Maria was litigated in Charlotte, North Carolina. The first one won, the second one lost. Identical facts. The judge in Charlotte was completely hostile to Central American claims, couldn't believe that they could be legitimate. So why 2014? Why was it that these two women found themselves in this crisis situation in that particular year? Well, I can't say for positive sure why, but I think it goes something like this. The number, the absolute power of the street gangs in these marginalized urban area was at a tipping point by 2014 because a number of factors, many of them U.S. Sponsored and driven, had come to bear their terrible fruit. What do I mean by that? Well, there was a massive deportation from the United States of Honduran nationals, Salvadoran, Guatemalan, convicted of crimes, often deported directly from prisons. Upon arrival in Honduras, they were subjected to what was known as the mano dura policies, which meant death squads, often executing these young men, usually men, deported back from the U.S., and they were put in prisons, mass incarceration, where these persons who may not have been particularly gang affiliated became very disciplined and radicalized by mass imprisonment. So to cut to the chase, by 2014, they had developed a very radical, very disciplined presence, and there was no match for them. Why was there no match for them? Well, the U.S., following the coup that they blessed in 2009 and the repression and corruption that it brought on, funneled its aid, and this question of aid to these countries has never been adequately addressed in the media because the aid is overwhelmingly military. The part of the aid that's supposed to go to protect people like Laura and Maria just never gets there. There is no local police. The prosecution, the criminal justice system is completely underwater. I mean, I was asked for gas money by the local police. There was one policeman for a town of 10,000. I mean, it goes on and on. So you have this complete vacuum of authority that the gangs fill. They become the government. They become a criminal insurgency that controls everything, and you cannot escape them. So if you're on their wrong side, and this often has to do with recruitment of children, teenagers, then you know, you've got a death mark on you. So what I'm talking about here, immigration scholars will refer to as the push factors. These are factors that push people out of Honduras, in this case, to whatever, to Mexico, to anywhere, to survive, to get away from death. And the pull factors, you know, the people that have been so hostile to these Central American refugees often say, they ignore the push factors. They don't want to know anything about them. They are ignorant of them. And they talk about, well, it's all pull factors. It's leniency in U.S. laws. I heard Mike Pence yesterday. He kept referring to the loopholes in the law as creating a magnet for refugees to come. And what he was really talking about was the International Convention for the Protection of Refugees and the Refugee Law of 1980. I would highly recommend it to the Trump administration that they bother to read it, because that law is what these would-be refugees are seeking to take advantage of. It is the law of the land, and Trump and Obama both did everything they could to thwart the law. How did they do that? Well, they did it by what I'll call the three D's. Deterrence. Deterrence somehow becomes the magic word for these pull factor advocates, including, you know, sadistic types like Steve Miller all the way to Obama officials in 2014. They say, well, if we deter these would-be asylum seekers by making conditions here really harsh, then they won't come at all. Well, that's never proven to be the case, because the pull factors would only come into play because of the push factors. So how do they make it even more disagreeable and more of a deterrence? Well, long-term detention or deportation. And what has Trump added to this? Well, what Trump has added to it is really a sadistic element, requiring that persons pending their asylum application wait on the Mexican side. But even beyond that, they've used the device of metering. In other words, let's say you have 1,000 people at Tijuana who want to be interviewed for asylum. And so what the Trump people have done is say, well, we can only see 50 a day. So that means that 950 are going to be, you know, waiting at the border for who knows, maybe months. And so this in turn creates the classic kind of Trumpian, a crisis that he creates, and then he later talks about heroic measures to resolve it. So the conditions in these detention facilities are just horrid. Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Had a special on it on June 12th, which I recommend. It takes a strong stomach. There's solitary confinement. There's terrible food. There's children in very harsh conditions. In addition to the people caged in Mexico, I mean, it's sort of like, you know, the likes of Steve Miller, anyone of his incompetence and sadistic nature would have been fired by a decent administration long ago, but he's one of the brains behind this idea of the immigrant raids to arrest 2,000 people that is ill-conceived and, if implemented, will be disastrous. So it's that's sort of, I think, in a nutshell, where we are. It didn't happen overnight with Trump. We just had the Trump particular spin on it. But note, my brief presentation underscores the following point. The push factors have never been addressed.
Yeah, they're so powerful that do you think the people in Honduras don't know what's going on? I mean, they've got to traverse a really hostile and long country, Mexico, in order to get here. Do you think that would any reasonable person be able to think that if you're fighting for the life of your children, if the only alternatives you see are for your children to become murderers or prostitutes, what's going to stop you from trying? You know, what are they going to do? Kill you? I mean, the options of deterring people by saying conditions are bad may immiserate people, but I don't think it's going to have an effect on the push factors you describe. And by the way, are there any, you know, we used to think of people crossing the border as young men looking for work. Is that happening now at all?
Well, no, which is an overstatement, but I mean, typically the Mexican border crosser for years and years and years was a young man, and those numbers have become negative now. They're so inconsequential. What's happened in this 2014 crisis, the 2018 crisis, is you're talking about women and children, families, unaccompanied minors. You're not talking about young men. Independently of their families. No, it's changed. It's a completely different population fleeing different conditions.
So
one thing I wanted to say, though, Mike, to follow up a little bit about the Honduran people. There's a remarkable book by Dana Frank called The Long Honduran Night, where she goes into detail of the resistance to the coup and the corruption. You know, there's an article by Jake Johnston in Intercept in August of 1917 on the role the U.S. played in the coup, the 2009 coup that deposed Zelaya and ushered in this very corrupt regime that has had the full backing of the Pentagon. And it's that regime that essentially has completely distorted the possibilities of providing protection in these neighborhoods where these people are being forced to flee. It just doesn't happen because of the military distortion, where it's the military that gets all the money and they could care less about what's going on in these neighborhoods. So November 2017, there was a presidential election where Hernandez, a big buddy of John Kelly, the former chief of staff, he was elected in clearly fraudulent ways. The U.S. recognized it the next day, But the Honduran people took to the streets en masse, and they were mowed down. There were many of them that were shot point blank. And I bring all of that up because the Honduran people consistently have tried to bring back the democracy that they had, however fragile it was before the coup. And they have been very brave in doing so. So they really want to have, you know, democratic institutions respond to their needs. But basically, the U.S. black-backed military is thwarted and killed them in their efforts to do so. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that a different U.S. policy could address and maybe make a real difference on the push factors. But so far, it just hasn't happened.
Well, why are they doing this? I've heard Honduras referred to as like a floating U.S. military base. There are so many U.S. military bases there, but don't they have any sort of agricultural economy, or do they have any manufacturing at all, or has the economy just simply dried up?
Well, the economy has certainly shrunk since the coup, and there's a couple of factors that I think are relevant here. You know, one, and I recommend Jake Johnstone's Intercept article because it's really good about how again and again the sort of Pentagon and Hillary Clinton types were saying, well, you know, we have very important military assets and investments in Honduras. We have a big base there. You know, there's arms sales. There's certain interests. Yeah. We need to protect those interests. Okay, we all know about that. On the other hand, in the rural areas, you've got extraction capitalism going on with the backing of the military, where, in other words, subsistence farmers will be dispossessed of their land so as to plant, you know, acres and acres of African palm, or in Guatemala, maybe coffee or biofuels. And if there's any resistance to that dispossession of the campesinos, then that's met with bloody repression by the same army that you and I are paying for, you know.
Well, James, we've got about a minute to go. Do you have any ideas in this bleak landscape of how we can minimize the push factors that are causing people to leave their homes where everyone would prefer to stay if it were possible and embark on the dangerous journeys that they're presently traveling?
Well, you know, I think the only hope, and Bernie Sanders and his work on the resolution about Saudi Arabia and Yemen gave me hope that the progressive forces in the Congress will start to focus on these push factors and hold hearings about them and hold the Pentagon to task for their misdirected policies. But the only way that's going to happen is you've got to have congressional people that are willing to make foreign policy in Central America, in this case, a priority. And other than that, I'm not very pessimistic that these issues will ever be addressed. Certainly, the media has done a terrible job about even talking about them.
Yeah, there's just a gaping void as to why women, why children 6 and 8 years old would start walking 1,000 miles through hostile country. Jim, it's great to hear from you, and thank you much, and I hope we get to talk again about this stuff.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer. Thanks to all participants today, Bill Resnick and Brenna Bell on protecting our forests, Fran Michelle's commentary on and reading from Rosa Luxemburg, Larry Golden for his review of Ella Carey's 2018 novel, Things We Don't Say, and to Mike Snedeker and Jim Smith for their update on what's happening at the border. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us at KBOO webpage or at OMOVariety, all one word, at gmail.com.